Good morning, everyone. It is Tuesday, March 21st, and you are listening to CITR 101.9's weekly news radio show, Against the Current. CITR is a community and campus radio station based here at UBC's Point Grey campus. We're located on the unceded, ancestral, and traditional territories of the Musqueam people. And every Tuesday at noon, we broadcast our weekly news radio show, Against the Current, where we talk about timely and relevant news coverage relating to the Lower Mainland. If you happen to miss our Tuesday episodes, you can always go back and listen to our podcast episodes on our website, citr.ca, or listen to our rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. My name is Jasmine, I'm the News Collective Lead, and I'll be your host for today's episode. And for today's episode, we're going to be doing a segment on affordability in Vancouver, followed by a conversation with Savani Guel from Climate Justice UBC about what CJUBC's demands of the AMS executives are for the upcoming school year. I will now hand it over to Theo and Scott to talk about affordability in Vancouver.
Vancouver's an expensive place to live in. 20-somethings in this city have had to deal with shady landlords, staggering rent increases, and disheartening trips that ironically name supermarkets like Save On Foods.
Yeah, I feel like we're all feeling the pinch right now, but for young people especially, I mean, speaking from my own experience, I recently took up swimming at the YMCA, and I've put off buying goggles because they're too expensive, and so I've been leaving the Y looking like I've just smoked a pound of weed.
Surely you don't have your eyes open underwater. That would be the mark of a madman.
I do. I do. I keep my eyes open underwater.
The people swimming opposite you must think you're absolutely deranged.
Yeah, I mean, I just try to ignore them. I try to ignore everyone. I feel quite ashamed. It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing, but the embarrassment is worth saving $30. Scott, what do you do to save money?
Well, I've learned to embrace the stinky towel. I've realized since I've needed new towels, that towels are really expensive. Now I go into Bed Baths and Beyond.
How much does a towel run you?
It's like at least $19 or $20 for a new towel.
How many towels would you say you need at this point?
I probably need at least 4. It's like I'm remarkably absorbent. I hold a lot of water after I wash.
They say that about the Brits, don't they?
What's the weirdest thing you've done to save money?
Okay, so in Croatia, the Airbnb had like a sandwich panini press, and we made ham, cream cheese, bagel, paninis for a week.
Wow. How did that make you feel?
Over the summer, I packed up all my belongings in boxes and labeled them as lab equipment and stuck them in our university's like lab room to avoid paying a storage unit for the summer, which would have been like about $120.
The craziest thing I've ever done to send money is spend 12 pounds on a bikini wax in the back of a community center.
And how did that make you feel?
It actually was a pretty good wax, I'm not gonna lie. You know, it was a starter rate, so it worked out.
That's iconic.
Yeah, I can't remember the last time I had a full body wax at the back of a community center, but I imagine there are better places to do it.
I have. It wasn't fun. Yeah, I mean, money will do that to people. I spoke to a guy who collects data on youth who live in cities, and he said, unsurprisingly, affordability is the biggest challenge facing young people right now. His name's Raj Dhaliwal, and he works for a company called Youthful Cities.
So I'm Raj. I'm a project lead at Youthful Cities. Been here for about 2 years now. What Youthful Cities really is trying to make cities better places for everyone, but especially young people, to live and thrive.
Raj and Youthful Cities use data to take action on making cities more youthful. They think about how young people can thrive in these spaces rather than just survive in them. But that's becoming harder and harder with the rising cost of living in Canadian cities.
Just recently in the last year here in 2022, we launched the Real Affordability Index, where we looked at 27 Canadian cities and can young people really afford to live in Canadian cities? When you're looking at kind of the different age brackets, so if you're looking at the under 24 age bracket, every city had a deficit for young people when we compared the cost of living to the to their incomes. 25, when you get above 25, then you kind of start seeing a small surplus in a monthly surplus for young people. But the most pressing issue really is still cost of living. That's kind of the one that we hear so often, and it's not kind of like a, it's not a perception either, right? It's a reality.
Their most recent data shows that in Vancouver, 20 to 24-year-olds on average run a monthly deficit of about $474. 25 to 29-year-olds on average make a surplus of about $605. And that doesn't leave a lot of wiggle room for young people living here. So I went out and I talked to a couple people in this predicament. Carmen and Gabrielle are friends and former roommates. They both graduated during COVID, are in their mid-20s, have full-time jobs, and are worried about money now and for the future.
My name is Carmen Best. I've been in Vancouver for about 6 years, and I'm trying to get enough hours of skilled labor to apply for PR. But I've been having like a little bit of a difficult time with that because I worked an under-the-table job for the past like 2-3 years. So none of that is counted. And now I'm kind of like running out of time a little bit to collect the hours before my work permit expires. But luckily I just got this new job like a month ago with this new company, and I do home staging and interior design for them.
My name is Gabrielle Savage. I was born just outside of Vancouver in Port Moody, and I love the city. And I currently live close to here in East Vancouver in a basement suite with a sick deal, which I love. And I can never leave now because it's the only affordable thing.
I think I find myself actually like pretty, really lucky. Compared to like a lot of other people that I know and a lot of other people in this city. I'm like the leaseholder of this whole house, and I've lived here for about 4 years, and I got it for $3,000 split four ways. So each of our rents are roughly about $700, and we're like right next to Commercial Broadway. We have chickens in the backyard, a front patio, back patio, huge garden. And it's a really lovely space. Like, in all honesty, I would have left Vancouver years ago if it wasn't for this house. Yeah, I'm really lucky amongst like the Vancouver housing crisis to be able to find this little gem.
Carmen lives in a cozy house with an old-timey vibe. The surfaces are speckled with a wide variety of candle holders. Carmen and Gabrielle were settled into a flowery Scandinavian couch across from a red brick fireplace. She says the whole place was furnished for free, but I can't really disclose how she managed to do that. She's pretty thrifty. She even supplies her eggs from the chickens in the backyard.
I've been kind of taking photos and documenting what I can get at Safeway compared to like what I can get at the 88 supermarket. I could get a box of pads, 2 frozen pizzas, toothpaste, yogurt, and I think like one other thing. And that was like $60 at Safeway. And then I go to like 88 Supermarket, and it was like 10 times more than what I could get at Safeway.
It was at this point during our interview that Carmen's roommate came home.
Less income since everywhere is like really expensive, but.
Oh, hello.
Hey. Hello, baby.
How's it going?
Good.
How are you doing? We're doing an interview.
Do you want to be interviewed?
For what?
I don't know, affordability and shit.
I can't afford anything. So
oh, well, Beth is currently unemployed.
Incorrect. I
what?
Got a job
today. Oh my God, Beth!
I know. That's awesome.
What?
Do yeah.
I think a lot of people in their 20s can probably relate to their anxieties, especially those living in Vancouver. So I spoke to Alejandro Rojas, who is a PhD candidate at UBC's School of Economics. And we sat down together on an unforgivingly frosty Vancouver morning, fueled only by coffee and biscuits. I was keen to find out whether these anxieties young people have might lead them to make financial mistakes. And Alejandra explained the errors young people are prone to making in the housing market and why it is so difficult to navigate.
This is very personal, but I think that one of the mistakes that people make is that when they're faced with a friendly housing market in which they have the possibility of acquiring assets, more precisely housing assets, in some cases it makes sense to, instead of renting out a property, to pay the mortgage for that property and accumulate wealth. Mm. And the reason is not only because this will allow you to, well, accumulate wealth, but also because the fact that you're going to have a house is going to give you some collateral. Mm. So one of the crises that I think that our generation has is in terms of house ownership. Mm-hmm. We have heard all of these stories about how millennials have been excluded from house ownerships by very rough housing market conditions that have many origins, many causes. But as long as it is possible, I think that recent graduates should think about the possibility of investing in some type of asset. Of course, it's not as straightforward. So for people who decide to stay in Vancouver, for example, they will not face a very friendly market. A one-bedroom apartment at around $1.2 million seems ridiculous in most housing markets. So in some cities, in some spaces, it does make sense to become a rentier and just there are better sources of accumulating wealth and having good financial decisions.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of investing in assets or housing is nice, but it's pretty much out of the realm of possibility for most young people in Vancouver right now. If you aren't backed by family money, you have a pile of student debt and a marginal amount of savings. What can you do?
I mean, I don't know anyone that's bought a house. Not even in the suburbs, actually. But I know people who are my age and have purchased apartments, and every single one of them has done so with financial aid from family, giving them a loan to make that down payment. I don't know anyone who's built their wealth enough at, 25, 6, 7, 8.
Absolutely not.
To be able to afford that on their own.
No.
Interesting stuff. And it seems some of this economic anxiety can bleed into some anxieties in people's social lives. So, fun fact, I used to date someone descended from the British aristocracy. Now, she was tremendously rich, but this wasn't really something that I was bothered about all that much. However, it is something that Gabriel and Carmen think about a lot.
And it, like, weirdly even influences aspects of my life about, like, who I'm going to date, you know? If I know that if I want to eventually own a home, either I need to, I don't know, have some cool business that I kick off and generate some extreme wealth quickly, or I need to just like date someone that's financially capable of doing that. And that's a shitty feeling. It's shitty to be like, oh, you aren't, I don't know, you don't have family wealth, like I don't want to date you. That's an awful thing, but it's something that I find myself thinking about.
Yeah, like Sol and I, we try, well, usually we just can afford like McDonald's. That's literally it. We go to McDonald's and it's Shamrock Shake season, so we're super stoked about that. But like it would be nice to be like in the movies or like in Seinfeld where, you know, they go out and have like a cocktail or they go out and eat food on a plate, you know? Like we don't, to pay for two people in this city is like, we can't afford it. And my partner, like, they work, they're on their 13th day in a row of working out of 14 days. They're working 25 days this month. It's like, even though they get like so much overtime and even double time after working for 2 weeks straight, it's, yeah, we still can't afford to go out because they also have like student loans to pay, they have their rent to pay, they have two cats. I just got this job, so we just have kind of been, our dates are usually just going for walks. I feel like this shouldn't be a thing, but the basis of a majority of our arguments is like money, and it sucks because I'm 25, they're 24, and we shouldn't be like bickering like, you know, 50-year-olds that are married with a mortgage.
It also affects the hobbies that they're able to pursue.
I really want to have hobbies, but I think the cost of them is mm-hmm. what really, and it's like basic hobbies. Like I want to make pants out of napkins or something, you know, but that involves like a sewing machine that involves fancy napkins. That's at least like $200 or something. I don't know.
I want to live a lifestyle that I enjoy, and I like to backcountry ski, and I like to do expensive sports, and having the ability to pay for those things is a luxury, and it's you know, it's kind of why people live in Vancouver a lot of the time, is for those experiences. So yeah, it feels right now like I'm really hoping to work hard and move up so that I can afford to do those things and also maintain good savings. But right now the savings are slow, and that freaks me out for the future.
But while Carmen and Gabrielle find the cost to live here overbearing, more young people are moving to Vancouver than in any other Canadian city.
When you kind of look at it at an overall aspect, Vancouver actually had the most young people move from other cities into Vancouver over the last 5 years out of the 30 municipalities we looked at, which is surprising, right? When you're talking about cost of living. So definitely there's more to a city that young people are looking for than just the affordability aspect.
The person I'm seeing is from Ontario. It's been his dream forever to come and live in BC, but he also is friends with a friend group who are all only Ontario people. And I'm talking like 40, 45 Ontario people in a group chat, and they've all come over to Vancouver because it's their dream, and they're all kind of supporting each other through it. And so some of them are more financially and career stable than others, and some of them are really struggling, but they're kind of like very much a community working together. I mean, I go to their hangouts and events, and I'm literally the only local person. So I think that there's just a lot that's appealing about the city.
So it seems like lots of young folks are moving to Vancouver, despite the affordability issues they might face. The crux of the problem is that the vast majority of young people are what Alejandro calls hand-to-mouth consumers. These are people who have very little savings or assets. Any kind of negative impact on the economy hit them harder, as they don't have additional sources of income and they're in a weak position in the housing market. Alejandro explains why high inflation is affecting young people more than your average Canadian household.
So the average Canadian household has faced an inflation of 10%. Let's say that this household hasn't received any type of nominal increase in its sources of income. This means that the capacity of the purchasing power of this household has fallen by 10%. If before it was able to buy 10 pints of beer, now he's only going to be able to buy 9 of those pints. The experience for those type of households has been quite different. Why? Because when you see, for example, rent inflation in British Columbia, more precisely in Vancouver, over the last 2 years, the price of a studio, the price of a one bedroom has increased around 35-40% in that period of time. Inflation has had there has been an inflation of around 15%, 20% in terms of food. Okay? Mm-hmm. So very rough estimation, if my consumption bundle is 50-50, rent has increased 40, prices in food have increased 30%. My effective inflation in my consumption bundle is 30%. Mm-hmm. Okay? So if my income has increased in the same period, my purchasing power has suddenly fallen by 30%. Mm-hmm. That compared to the average Canadian household in the economy means that as a graduate student who is mainly facing shocks that are reflected in the price of renting and the price of food, I will no longer be able to buy not 9 beers, but I will only be able to buy 7 beers compared to that average household.
Gabrielle and Carmen see this situation playing out around them. They've both been lucky enough to find great deals, but it also means that they feel like they can't move.
So when I moved in, there was a tenant and he paid $8.95 for that micro suite. And then they had another tenant come in, and I think she paid $980 for it. And then recently this year, 2023, a third tenant has come in and now she pays $1,100, which is exactly what I pay after moving in 2 years ago. So the fact that this micro suite, which is 295 square feet, is now the same price as my living room, kitchen, one den, one bedroom, larger suite in the same home, makes me feel really weird. Mm-hmm. But also I recognize that it kind of locks me into where I live now, which, but I know that if I leave, my suite will now be going for $1,600, $1,700 or more.
I like how you say, like, you feel stuck, because I kind of feel the same way. Like, I do love this house, but it's been 4 years. I'm in my mid-20s, and I want to start to explore. Like, the pandemic's over. I want to start to explore other places and other neighborhoods, or, but I can't. Like, there's no way. There's absolutely no way.
Just being in a position where I can make the rent really limits my ability to develop my life more. It like inhibits a lot of choices I would make otherwise, like if I had the choice to move.
With all this talk of issues around housing, ownership, dating, and groceries, is living in Vancouver even a viable option in the long run?
I think amongst our friend group, I'm seen as very successful and cool because I live alone and have a cool job now.
That's true.
I'm still struggling. Like, I pay a little bit more than everybody else for my lifestyle, and it scares me sometimes to feel like I am a disorganized mess. I'm not building wealth very quickly, and I had a vision of, you know, I'm from Vancouver. I don't want to leave the city, and I want to live here, but I recognize that me owning a home here is probably never going to happen, which is painful, but something that I accept. My family is not from a wealthy background. My parents still do not own their home. They've been renting the same house for 24 years. Yeah, but I know that I'll never own something here unless something extraordinary happens.
I think to thrive in Vancouver, just even like with a thinking about the future, to thrive in the future in Vancouver, like, that's not going to happen. I think I'm going to go to Montreal because a lot of artists are leaving the city, and a lot of people who stay and who their definition of thriving in the city, I don't think is necessarily art, but more so sports. And I think the people who can like afford to be here are the ones that are interested in sports rather than art. And I feel like a lot of the artists just keep on getting pushed out.
An inability to live in Vancouver is something the soon-to-be Dr. Rojas is pondering too.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to live in Vancouver in the long run, but yeah, that is something that I'm actively thinking about. So one of the things that I was concerned about during COVID is the increasing housing prices, because with those increases in housing prices, it suddenly seemed as if that possibility for recent graduates or people who were going to graduate in the following years just seemed more unreachable. This is something that we still need to see. Prices have been falling over the last 6 months in most advanced economies. The Canadian economy, at least last time I checked, there has been like a 12% fall in some cities, Toronto, for example. But yeah, we'll have to see. It seemed at least during COVID that objective was becoming more unreachable.
And it hasn't always been like this in Vancouver.
When we're talking about, you know, whether it's cities or Canada as a whole, for young people to be in a position of, you know, giving back to the economy, giving back to our cities, rather than always being on that on the other side of the fence where they're kind of seen as like, you know, we're becoming an expense for the city. They're always complaining, et cetera, right? The important aspect is looking at the long term, right? When you're looking at 30 years ago, the amount of money you needed for a down payment for a home was way less when you look at it on par with the increase in wages. So inflation and wages haven't kept up.
My mom will frequently talk about how when she was 19, she worked at a hardware store and had her own apartment in Vancouver. And that is just not something that would be possible really in this day and age. Maybe if you lived in a shared home, but certainly not your own apartment above ground on like the third floor of a building. You could not work at Home Depot as a clerk and afford that unless it was almost all of your rent.
There's a shift, right? There's going to be an ongoing shift with every generation and the way we think about, you know, what is livability for us.
I don't know. I love this communal living. Like I know a lot of friends that kind of like live in this like communal, you know, household. Like we're mid-20s, we all live together, and honestly, like, I see myself at, like, 30 and still doing the same thing. And maybe even, like, 35 and still doing the same thing. Because it's, like, all of us together, forget about owning a house, can't even rent a house by ourselves.
Oh, and Carmen revealed the craziest thing she does to save money.
Well, it's not crazy. I feel like everyone does it. Well, everyone steals cheese, right? Everyone steals cheese. I'm not going to say exactly where I steal the cheese, but everyone steals the cheese. The cheese is insane.
So if you are one of Carmen's future housemates and you notice a suspicious surplus of cheese in the fridge, now you know why.
I bought a Costco membership specifically so I could afford cheese. I've got a ridiculous amount of cheese.
Well, you know, they say sharing is caring, Theo. You mustn't leave me cheeseless now. We want to say a huge thank you to everyone we spoke to, and especially Raj Dhaliwal, Carmen Best, Gabrielle Savage, and Alejandro Rojas for sitting down with us and featuring in this report.
Thanks, Theo and Scott. We'll be launching into a short break now, but after the break, we're going to talk to Savani Gwal, a CJUBC representative, about the organization's demands of the AMS for the upcoming school year.
You know what I could go for right now? Authentic flour tortillas pan-fried until golden brown.
Yum!
Or vegan taco kits filled with traditional Mexican chilies and spices.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Or how about vegan potato and chorizo taquitos?
How can I get these foods immediately?
Buy Lita's Mexican Foods.
Sounds delicious. Tell me more.
Lita's Mexican Foods is a female-managed, plant-based Mexican food innovator in BC. Their products come prepackaged and frozen at tons of local grocery stores around Metro Vancouver. Not to mention they can be cooked in under 10 minutes.
Wow, that sounds perfect for me. I've been so busy lately and dinner takes so long to make. Where can I get my hands on some Lita's Mexican Foods?
Lots of places. Whole Foods, Choices, Stong's, Vegan Supply, Donald's, and even UBC Bookstore. Hey, where are you going?
To buy some Lita's Mexican Foods. See you later.
See ya. You want to change the state of the world, but instead you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both. Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing healthcare, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder, because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well start supporting.
Words before I go to sleep. I feel like I'm gonna dream tonight. Big bad ones, you know? The kind you like.
There is a lot of music out there, but only some is strange enough for you. My name is B, and on SlimeWire, I do the work for you, picking out freaky tunes to rule your nighttime world. So check it out, every Wednesday at 10 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Organize UBC wants to unionize student workers. Are you a research assistant, an academic assistant, or a work learn? For far too long, student workers have endured low wages, no job protection, and poor working conditions. Organize UBC is fighting back, and all they ask is for student workers to sign a card on their website so the union becomes certified. To sign a card and to find out more information, go to organizeubc.cupe.ca.
All right, welcome back, everyone. You are listening to CITR's weekly news radio show, Against the Current. And for the final half of today's episode, we'll be chatting with Savani Gwell, a representative from CJUBC, about their demands of the AMS for the upcoming year. So the first thing that I wanted to ask you is how CJUBC feels about Esme Decker winning the AMS elections as the representative of Remy the Rat.
We're very, very happy that Esme Decker did get elected, and we look forward to having hopefully a more like trusting, a more like transparent like interaction with the AMS going forward now, because obviously like there's been like certain like transparency issues and like certain candidates like not like upholding certain promises. We look forward to working with Esme because CJUBC has like, you know, we've like interacted and worked with Esme before, and since they're a candidate that also like endorses like divestment, and we look forward to how this will look for next year.
Can you tell me a bit more about what your specific demands are as CJUBC of the AMS president in the coming year?
In short, our demands are divest from, you know, the World Bank of Canada, RBC, because there is, you know, currently an RBC branch in the nest. And we want to hold RBC accountable for its investments in fossil fuels because it is the largest fossil fuel funder in Canada currently. And so one of our biggest demands is divestment from RBC. Our second demand is to support community reinvestment for both UBC and the AMS, and to hold UBC accountable to the Climate Emergency Task Force recommendations, and to advocate to allocate permanent funding to them.
Can you also tell me a little bit more about what your demands are of VP Finance?
We have major demands for both like the AMS president and VP Finance, again, because Climate Justice UBC's major campaigns are divestment and reinvestment. And so, again, we want for the VP Finance to also call for community reinvestment for both UBC and the AMS. We want them to update the AMS investment policy to invest a portion in community reinvestments. We want them to meet with our suggested advisors and to create a council to advise on community reinvestments, including members of Climate Justice UBC to be on that council, and to be very transparent with where the AMS invests their money, and to publish all of the AMS investments, and to hopefully move towards more fossil-free funding. We want them to remove the RBC branch from the nest, and to hopefully have like another credit union in their place, such as like Vancity, because they have their investments placed in more ethical places, and to incorporate all of the Climate Emergency Task Force recommendations into sustainability projects funding. What we mean by like community reinvestment is that investing capital, often from funds that have like divested from fossil fuels, into projects that provide social and or environmental benefits to local communities. Community reinvestment prioritize meeting community needs while still generating like modest returns for investors. And so our demands are, okay, first and foremost, to integrate social and environmental impact across all asset classes and pools of capital. So UBC, SFU, and UVic should build on their progress in divesting from fossil fuels to set broader norms around ethical and environmental standards in using all the tools available, including pressuring companies to change their practices and divesting from companies that fail to meet such standards. Climate justice necessities going beyond measuring emissions and considering companies' impacts on workers, human rights, indigenous rights, and local communities, which includes aligning investments with the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples and Indigenous Peoples' right to free, prior, and informed consent, to create new asset classes, designation for community impact investments with an initial allocation of at least 10 million each by 2023 and a long-term target of 10% of university investment assets. Truly, we want them to move towards truly responsible investing, and which must go beyond minimizing harm towards like actively cultivating social, economic, and environmental well-being. UBC, SFU, and UVic should invest a portion of their assets into projects that directly support community economic development and advance social and environmental objectives. And these investments should have a primary purpose of community impact, with financial returns being a secondary objective. They should be governed by a community investment committee composed of students, staff, faculty, alumni, and local community members, all who have relevant experience and expertise. And so thirdly, we want them to engage with all First Nations on whose land the universities occupy regarding the investment of university funds. Our universities must involve host nations in decisions related to investments in order to uphold their commitments to reconciliation and decolonization. Which is exemplified in UBC's Indigenous strategic plan. And this is especially important at UBC because 22% of our endowment funds come from land lease revenues.
What kind of advocacy you would like to see from the VP External towards the BC government?
So in like terms of community reinvestment, we'd want them specifically to get other student unions on board with our campaign on divestment and reinvestment, and to really collaborate with one another and to to collectively apply more pressure on RBC and to hopefully have a joint letter expressing concerns and threatening to move to other more fossil free forms of funding in other banks or credit unions. And we want them to advocate to the government for climate funding for universities for research, education, and infrastructure, because currently, a lot of climate research is funded through fossil fuel. And so we want to really move towards a fossil free funding for more things and to have general climate advocacy. And we should we want them to advocate for the AMS and to sign on to the campaign for BC to strengthen its climate plan with no new fossil fuels expansions. We want them to advocate and to sign on to campaigns for a just transition and Green New Deal investments, etc. And of course, in coalitions with other student unions so that we can really have a large body of people advocating for BC to strengthen its climate plans and to move towards a just transition.
Under VP Academic, you also have listed just helping advertise and engage students with climate emergency campaigns. What would you hope that looks like?
Currently, what we really demand from the AMS is to have a trusting and transparent relationship with them. We'd want to have regular communication going with them. We'd want to have them understand, listen, and to support our demands and not figuratively and quite literally shut us out. We look forward to having meaningful discussions with our new AMS executives. We look forward to like collaborating and finding new ways forward rather than being shut out and like left to like struggle to find for like, you know, find like information on like on our own.
Can you also tell me a little bit about what you mean by holding UBC accountable to the Climate Emergency Task Force recommendations?
Yes. So basically it's been 2 years since UBC, it's been a few years since UBC has declared a climate emergency and the university has yet to allocate like permanent funding to respond to this crisis. UBC, like Climate Justice UBC, like Climate Hub, Climate Justice Center and others like have like already like sent like letters and advocated for UBC to place their money like where their mouth is in committing to address the climate crisis. And since the endorsement of the task force report, UBC has hired like, you know, some full-time staff to support the implementation of the recommendations, and a student-initiated like climate emergency fund has also been dispersed to several important projects advancing those recommendations. And while like both have been very essential, those commitments are still relatively short term, and the UBC must extend the lifespan of the climate emergency fund and create permanent positions for climate emergency project managers. Because the climate emergency is not a time-bound project that can be addressed through one-off funding initiatives. It is an ongoing emergency and requires sustained and consistent funding in order to treat it as an actual emergency. And so furthermore, the climate emergency fund was initiated by students and not the university. So this funding would not have been available for climate emergency action without the leadership of the AMS and the GSS. So the funding came from surplus tuition revenue, which is neither financially sustainable nor ethical way to finance UBC's climate emergency response. And students should not have to bear the responsibility of assembling funds to pay for UBC's climate emergency response. And so we understand that other funds from different parts of the university have been allocated to the climate emergency response, but a climate lens needs to be embedded across the university, like hiring decisions, in order for UBC to fully mobilize its resources to meet this challenge.
Can you tell me more about what your demands are around teaching and learning from the Senate?
Yeah, we want to ensure that all the programs are in alignment with a just transition and zero carbon future, and we need to integrate climate emergency and like climate justice perspectives into courses across disciplines. We like, for example, like environmental ethics courses and all, et cetera, and like supporting professors to redesign their courses and to integrate climate content into like, you know, again, all different like disciplines, and having like a lot, yeah, supporting professors to redesign their courses and integrating climate content into their courses and lectures, and yeah, and also like we'd like them to support climate research because we'd like them to support climate research and to stop really funding research through fossil fuels as well, because again, when UBC allows for the fossil fuel industry to fund research, UBC gives the fossil fuel industry like a social license by accepting their funds. And so we want for research also to be to phase out fossil fuel funding and research.
And that wraps it up for today's episode. Thank you all for listening, and I hope to see you again next week.